Open up to Daniel chapter 3, if you would. Daniel chapter 3 in your Old Testament, that's where we'll find a beginning place for our study this evening. Thank you so much
for being here. Thank you for the opportunity that you have extended to me to speak with you. For so many of you who have graciously opened up your homes or spent time with my wife and myself outside of services, we are deeply thankful. And we have been greatly impressed by the generosity and by the pleasant spirit of those that make up this congregation. Thank you so much for allowing us to be a part of this week. As we're in Daniel chapter 3, Daniel chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Why we call them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and we still call Daniel all the time, I don't know. Isn't it a shame that we know them as that? We ought to know them as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the names that glorified God, the names that they were given at their birth. But as you come into Daniel 3, Daniel and friends have been promoted within the kingdom. You look at the very end of chapter 2, Daniel is now ruler over the province of Babylon, and he's head of the wise men in Babylon. This province in Babylon is most likely the capital province in Babylon, so Daniel is pretty well high up within the kingdom. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, as you see at the end of verse 49, are set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. They have a relatively high position, governmental position, in the nation at this time. But as we come over into chapter 3, we are confronted by Nebuchadnezzar here again. We don't really know the time frame. No historical context really given to this. The best that we can understand from what is going to be said later in the chapter is that this occurs chronologically after chapter 2, and it occurs chronologically before chapter 5 when Belshazzar comes into power. But that's really the extent of what we know chronologically about this. In verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width was 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Doesn't invite the common people, invites all the governmental workers. What a wonderful party that had to be. That was sarcasm. Verse 4. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples and nations and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." He sets up the image. The result of refusing to worship this image is death. Note again, we did a character profile of Nebuchadnezzar last night. Note what this says about him. He constructs the image. He apparently was a very handy, a very crafty person. But he esteems his image so highly that when you hear the music playing, you're going to bow down and you're going to worship the image that I have created. You see somebody who's very prideful. A theme that will be repeated as you come into chapter 4 and dealt with exclusively or dealt with extensively there. Let's talk about this image. The description of this image, as you see, it is made of gold. He makes this image of gold, sets it up there in the plain of Dura. That he made it of gold did not mean that it had to be constructed of pure solid gold. You see the same type of language used in 1 Kings chapter 6, verses 21 and 22, and it refers to something that was overlaid with gold, but it is yet still called being made of gold. So it could simply be gold-plated, we might say, and that would fit the bill here. The dimensions of it, 60 cubits by 6 cubits, we would call it 90 feet by 9. And contrary to what many people submit, there's no indication to us at all that what Nebuchadnezzar has set up here is the statue that he saw in his dream in chapter 2. It just simply says that he has erected an image here. It doesn't say anything about it being the statue that he saw from chapter 2. And indeed, this has been a cause for concern amongst many skeptics of the biblical text, who will come over here and say, look, if you're talking about Nebuchadnezzar is making this statue that he made from chapter 2, which so many assume that he's doing in chapter 3, they say, look, that's just impossible as it relates to this structure actually being self-supporting and standing. And I would submit to you that most likely what you've got going on here is Nebuchadnezzar constructing what we would call an obelisk. What's an obelisk? The Washington Monument is an obelisk. It's very tall, pointy at the top. This seems to be most likely what Nebuchadnezzar has erected and called the people to worship. Some would argue there's not enough gold in Babylon for such an image. The response would simply be that this is a gold-plated. It is overlaid with gold, and there would be plenty of gold for that. Some would indicate that this statue could not stand, and the response would be, well, there's no indication this is a statue. And in fact, we know that there are obelisks that can stand that have similar dimensions. This is Cleopatra's Needle, if you've ever been to New York City and been in Central Park. You might have seen this. Cleopatra's Needle, which was originally in Egypt, built around 1450. So predates what we're seeing here in the book of Daniel by a few centuries, quite a few centuries actually. This needle is 67 feet tall, and it is around 8 feet at the base. And so the dimensions for an obelisk in chapter 3 are perfectly acceptable as it relates to this object being freestanding. You can read more in the architect and builder's pocketbook if you ever get bored and you need to sleep at night. There's more than 1,800 pages there for you. Okay, I wouldn't suggest it, but if you're brave or you like architecture like that, go for it. So as you answer the critics here, the height and the width fits. There's nothing amiss with it being 60 by 6 cubits. And you've got this connection with the worship of the sun god. This obelisk, where is it pointing? Well, obelisks point up to the sun. And it's overlaid with gold. Well, what color is the sun? And you see a lot of connection there as well. It would not be a stretch of the imagination to have Nebuchadnezzar setting up an image here referencing the sun god of the Babylonians, whom they would be called to worship when all of these musical instruments sound. This furnace in verse 6, I've always wondered about this burning fiery furnace. Most likely what it is what's called a lime kiln or a limestone kiln. You would, and we'll see a picture of this in just a moment, you would take the limestone, you would put it in at the top, you would heat it really hot so that the lime would be extracted. And the lime would come out, and you could use that lime, especially in building mortar. You could also use it as a stabilizer. But this is most likely what they're using to throw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into, this lime kiln. And it can be heated to approximately 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit with a mixture of chaff and crude oil. To put that into perspective, our ovens and our kitchens normally run, 500, 550 degrees. If you've got one of the self-cleaning ones with the locks, those will get anywhere from 900 degrees up to around 1,100 degrees. You remember the sad story, I think it was about a month ago, the firefighters in Arizona who lost their lives in that wildfire. You read maybe that they deployed their emergency tents, like sleeping bag little looking things, to try to save their lives when that wildfire turned. Those sleeping bags, to put it into perspective, those emergency fire shelters are rated to 500 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're looking at something here that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are going into that is double what those men used in Arizona and still perished even within that shelter. This is not probably exactly what it would look like. This is a reconstruction artist rendering of one, but you can see the idea here. You put the limestone in up here. As you read later in the text, they're going to put Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in from the top, which would be consistent with this. You've got the fire kindled in there, burning. Limestone comes down, and eventually you're able to extract the lime. If you're interested in how it works, that is roughly how it would have gone. At the sound of the music, you come over to chapter 3 and verse 8. Chapter 3 and verse 8, at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. And they spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage and fury, forgets pretty quickly about chapter 1, forgets pretty quickly about chapter 2. He flies into a rage and fury. He gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought the men before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Is it true that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time that you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, and fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Got to get some foreshadowing about what Nebuchadnezzar is going to learn in chapter 4. Who is the God that will deliver you from my hand? There are some who argue about the date of the book of Daniel by saying this word psaltery here is a Greek word, which indeed it is. And Daniel is using a Greek word here, which means, number one, either Daniel didn't write the book, or Daniel is more of a 300 B.C.'s character than he is 600, which would make the prophecies that he has in here not so much prophecies as they are mere observations of the political landscape at the time, which would then defeat the idea that you see demonstration of predictive prophecy within the Scriptures. It's an argument of the skeptics, but there is a very rational explanation, just like there are for most of those arguments. Go back to 710 B.C., when Assyria is still a country, and you can read that the Assyrian king, Sargon II, had made contact with the nation of Greece. They had trade and communication back and forth, and you remember in 612 B.C., Assyria is going to fall to whom? Well, they fall to Babylon. And Babylon is going to subsume that kingdom, and thus the Greek influences that had begun to penetrate into that kingdom. We see the same type of thing with this, though, happening in our society today. We have instruments that are called foreign names, but we retain those names. Piano is not English. Piano is not an English word. Neither is viola. Those are all words that we have borrowed from different languages. And so the mere fact that this word psaltery is used does not indicate a later date for the book of Daniel. All it does is indicate that the Greek influence had been present in these two countries. That may be more about Greek language and musical instruments than you ever wanted to know. But if it ever comes up, now you know something. We'll move on, though. Look at chapter 3 and come down here to verse 21. They refuse to bow down and worship the image, and so in verse 21 they're going to be cast into the burning fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar in verse 19 is full of fury. The expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times hotter than it was normally heated. I wouldn't submit to you that they're heating the oven to 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit. I would submit to you that you use this idea of 7 here the same way that the term 7 is used in chapter 4 and verse 25. When Nebuchadnezzar is turned into that beast of the field until 7 times pass over you, a complete period of time, a period of time that would lead to Nebuchadnezzar learning God rules in the kingdoms of men and gives them to whomsoever he pleases. The point of it here in chapter 3 and verse 19 would be this. Nebuchadnezzar is angry, Nebuchadnezzar is mad, and he is demonstrating it by making this furnace hotter than normal. To the extent, you know the story there in verse 20, that when they throw them in verse 21, they throw them in here, and what happens to the men that are throwing them in? Well, they're killed because the heat is so tremendous. So, we have them going into the burning fiery furnace. You come to verses 22 and 23. They look into the burning fiery furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar begins to see something he doesn't expect. These three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, verse 23, fell down, they were put in at the top, fell down into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" And they answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "But look," he answered, "I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire. And they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." If you are using newer translations, maybe the ESV, the NASB, or other translations, it might say a son of the gods, or son of the gods, something along those lines. Nebuchadnezzar sees this fourth man that he is shocked to see. The best I can tell, the Aramaic here should be properly rendered, he looks like a son of God. I don't think Nebuchadnezzar here is confessing the identity of the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. I don't think he's identifying this man as the Son of God. We don't see Nebuchadnezzar having much of a regard for the God of heaven right now. The Aramaic of chapter 3 and verse 25 lacks the definite article before son. It's not the son, it's just son of a God. So Nebuchadnezzar is not so much confessing Jesus Christ here, I don't believe personally. He's merely identifying the fourth person as best he can. Does that mean then that, well, what does it tell us about this fourth person? Well, we're not given any answer from Daniel. We're not given any answer from any other biblical author as to the identity of the fourth person. It could have been an angel. It could have been the angel of the Lord and the significance that that holds in Old Testament Scripture. But whomever it is, whoever this fourth person is, it is very obvious what their presence indicated. Their presence indicated the guidance and the care and the protection of the God of heaven. God was with these men. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah emerge fully intact. You look at chapter 3 and verse 27. Chapter 3 and verse 27, the satraps, the administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of the fire was not on them. God brings them through this completely and wholly unscathed. They don't even smell like fire. Hasn't even touched their clothing. And you see the end of it there in verse 29, the response of Nebuchadnezzar. He goes near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and he calls out to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, "Servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." My, how our opinion has changed from "Who is the God who will deliver you from my hand" now to "Servants of the Most High, come out." The satraps, the administrators, and the governors saw their composure. They saw their how they looked afterwards. And in verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be reduced to an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. You see a shift with Nebuchadnezzar again. Maybe not a complete one, certainly not a complete one. But we're seeing him move. That moral compass in Nebuchadnezzar is moving bit by bit. He's coming to more and more recognition. Let's look at the story now and let's draw some practical applications for ourselves. And as you look back at verses 16 and 17, we see a lesson similar to one that we saw yesterday evening, and that is this. Faith doesn't mean we have every answer. It has been said of the stories in the book of Daniel that we read that they are stories that children enjoy, but they are stories that only adults can appreciate. I think you see the truth in that here. We loved as kids, at least I liked as kids, hearing the story of the den of lions and the burning fiery furnace. But we don't really grasp the frightening degree of all of that and how severe of a test that was until we become a little bit older and we've experienced some things ourselves. You look at what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are confronted with there in chapter 3 and verse 16. Nebuchadnezzar just said, "Now who's the God that's going to deliver you from my hand?" And they respond with characteristic composure, just like we saw with Daniel the other evening. They say in verse 16, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." They're not being rude here. They're not being uppity. They're just giving a response. "Nebuchadnezzar, our answer is not going to change with the threat that you have given us." Verse 17, "If that is the case, if you're going to throw us into the burning fiery furnace, then Nebuchadnezzar, know that our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from said burning fiery furnace. And He will deliver us not only from the furnace, but also from your hand, O King." But look at verse 18. But if not, if He doesn't deliver us, then know this, O King, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah knew what was right. They knew what was right by revelation. You look at Deuteronomy chapter 5, which is a restatement of the Ten Commandments. And they knew the restrictions about worshiping other gods. They knew the restrictions on graven images and things like that. They knew what was right, and they knew what was right because God had revealed what was right. God is the source of right. That's the only way we learn what is right and what is wrong in this life, by the revelation of our God. And He had revealed very plainly and very clearly to all of Israel what was right and what was wrong. And you see these three young men here taking a stand for what they knew was right. They knew what was right, and they stood by that. "We have no need to answer you, O King. We're not going to change just because you're threatening us. You can threaten us with violence. You can threaten us with destruction. You can threaten us with death. But we're not going to change." Why? The principles of right and wrong don't change. We're going to do what's right for the singular fact that it's right. And your threats aren't going to change that. But not only did they know what was right, they knew God's power. Something they had seen back in chapter 2. Something they had experienced themselves back in chapter 2. And they say, they confess there in verse 17, "Look, we have no doubt in our God. We fully trust that our God is able to deliver us." But then comes verse 18. "Our God can deliver us, but we don't know whether He will or not." Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah knew that God could deliver, but they did not know if God would deliver. Faith doesn't mean, like we said last night, that we know every outcome. But faith means that we have confidence in the One who does know these things. Perhaps it's because we are so far separated from the days of miracles that we might sometimes begin to doubt God's ability to be involved in the affairs of lives today because He does not work miracles anymore. But let me submit this to you. God doesn't have to part the Red Sea to be involved in our lives today. He doesn't have to do that. And we need look no further than the story of Joseph, or the story especially of Esther, to see that. God didn't have to work a miracle in either of those instances. God doesn't have to part the Red Sea to be involved in our lives. God can work providentially using the choices and the decisions that we and others make to bring us where we need to be. He can use these things to mold us and to make us better, as we'll see in just a moment. But don't think that just because we live in a day where miracles do not occur, don't think then that God is somehow uninvolved. We need faith in God. We need to believe in His promises, like we have talked about all week from Matthew chapter 6. God's promise to provide and take care of His children. We covered this in depth, so let's move on. Let's notice here what we see as it relates to the nature of true friendship. Back in Daniel chapter 2, did you catch what was thrown in at the end of verse 49? True friendship is evidenced by activity. True friendship can only be seen in the actions in which we engage. The end of chapter 2, verse 49. Daniel is promoted, but what does he do in verse 49? Daniel's been promoted. He's up high in the kingdom. But he did what? He petitioned the king. He set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Daniel was faithful to those who were faithful with him. Daniel didn't forget those who in chapter 2 prayed with him to the God of heaven that he might get a revelation and understand not only Nebuchadnezzar's dream, but also the interpretation thereof. Daniel didn't forget about these men who had stood by him. The men that stood with Daniel, Daniel remembered them. And he acted towards them in an acceptable way. Is our concern for one another genuine? How do we treat one another? Look in your New Testament at 1 John chapter 3. We can talk about loving each other, and we can talk about being a family of believers and things like that, and that's good. We ought to talk about such things. But is it a reality? Do we really love each other? Are we really concerned about one another? 1 John chapter 3, verses 16 through 18. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? Now notice verse 18. My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. It's not just enough to talk about it. We ought to talk about it. It ought to be a part of our conversation. We ought to be comfortable talking about such things. But unless what we're doing moves beyond the level of talking, it never meets what God wants from us. There's got to be that genuine concern. Doesn't mean you have to be buddy-buddy with everybody. I know there are some people that get on my nerves. There are probably some people that get on your nerves. Goodness, for all I know, I might get on your nerves, and that's perfectly acceptable. But we still have to be concerned about each other. We still have to love each other. Loving each other, being a part of the Christian family, having this responsibility towards one another involves not only talking, but doing. Are we active towards one another? How about this? Go to John chapter 15. I hear people come up to me sometimes and say, you know what, I don't have friends. I don't have friends. Well, the writer of the book of Proverbs would say, a man who has friends must himself be friendly. There's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. If we're going to have friends, we have to be friendly. But I'm pretty well convinced there are some people that and I say this in all genuineness, just don't know a whole lot about being friendly. They want friends, but they don't know how to start that process. And I would submit to you, it's the same thing that we have seen throughout the course of this week, is that if we're going to build any relationship at all, it's dependent upon communication. Listen to what Jesus said about friendship in John chapter 15 and verse 14. He has been talking to his disciples here as they are going out to the garden where he will be betrayed. He's been talking to them and bracing them for what's about to occur. And he says here in verse 14, you are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants. For a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known to you. Friends communicate. That's how friendship is strengthened. That's how any relationship is strengthened, by communication. That's how Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that's how they grew stronger together. That's how they banded together, by communication. Communication is a necessity if we're going to build the bonds of friendship. But go back to Daniel chapter 3. another hallmark of true friendship is that true friends stand together in the face of intimidation. True friends stand together in the face of intimidation. Chapter 3 and verse 12, Nebuchadnezzar is angry, Nebuchadnezzar is mad, he flies into a rage. I'm going to kill you if you don't bow down and worship my image. And what do the three friends do? Well, they stand before the king and they say, we're going to do what's right. You can take our lives. You can torture us. You can do whatever you want to us. But we're not going to compromise with what we know is right. And it would be wrong to worship the image. Look at Proverbs chapter 17 with me. True friendship stands united together before intimidation. Proverbs chapter 17. In Proverbs chapter 17 and in verse 17. Here's the nature of true friendship. A friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. The person who leaves you when you're going through the time of crisis, the person who abandons you, is not your friend. They're just not. And we have such a hard time grasping that sometimes. We have such a hard time coming to the realization sometimes that the people that we want to be the closest to us are many times the people that don't need to be that close to us. The people that would abandon us, the people that would leave us, the people that would walk away from us in time of crisis, that's not a friend. Not at all. You see that when you look at the prodigal son, right? In Luke chapter 15, he has all the money. He goes to the foreign land. And for a while there, he's living like a high roller. And then what? The money's all used up, and where were the people who had been tagging along and partying with him? Well, they're noticeably absent, aren't they? And he's now working slopping hogs. Not very pleasant, especially for a Jewish boy. And then think about this. As you look at Daniel chapter 3 and verse 18, friends stand together for what's right. Mark it down, write it down, highlight it, underline it, take it to the bank. Friends stand together for what is right. More to the point, friends do not solicit each other to do evil. Let's look at Proverbs chapter 12. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 26. The righteous should choose his friends carefully, the writer says. Chapter 12 and verse 26, the righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. Who do you let into your life? Who's closest to you? Who are the people that you most frequently associate with? And yeah, we talk about this in relation to our young people. And it's an absolutely proper application. Look at Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 6 with me. The person is not your friend if they try to get you to do what's wrong. And that's it. We need to accept that. The person who tries to get me to do something that is wrong is not my friend. It may be a hard pill to swallow. It may be something that is unpleasant to deal with. But it is a realization to which we must come. The person who would seek to get us to do what is wrong is not a friend. And right, we can nudge our kids in the pew and say, listen to him. He's right. Let me tell you, this lesson applies just as quickly to parents and to older people as it does to our junior high and high school kids. Because I have seen a whole lot of parents and I've seen a whole lot of older people who made friends with the world or who made friends with people who brought them down spiritually and have now just left the Lord because of the influence of the people that they called friends. Friends do not solicit us to do evil. In Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 6, just because somebody might tick me off doesn't mean they're a bad person. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Just because somebody might have something to say to me that I don't like, that may be particularly unpalatable to me, doesn't mean that that person doesn't have my best interest in mind. And it doesn't mean that I automatically just disqualify whatever they say is, well, you know what, they just don't like me and they can go deal with it and butt a stump. No. We ought to hear things. We ought to open up and listen and consider some things. But here's the truth about friendship. Friends don't solicit us to do evil. We need to mark that down. We need to take that to the bank. We need to understand it. And more than that, we need to live our lives in recognition of that principle. If people are trying to tear us down and trying to drive a wedge between us and God, whether they realize it or not, we need to separate ourselves from that ungodly influence. We need to quit feeling so at home in the world. Doesn't mean we can't enjoy each other's company. But we've got to pick and choose the right people with whom we associate. And then consider this with me finally. And it's something that might seem a bit backwards at first, but it's this. Sometimes the furnace is the best thing. Sometimes the furnace is the best thing. You're thrown down into the fiery furnace. Hundreds of degrees in temperature. You don't know what you're in for when you're cast down into it. But you get in there and you quickly notice nothing's happening. I'm not burning. I'm not dying. I'm really not even in pain. And you look around and you see one more person there with you than when you got in. Wouldn't you like to know what that conversation was about? And then you walk out. Don't smell like smoke, not burned. Hair's not singed. You just walk out. You think at the end of the day, Hannah and I, Mishael and Azariah would have done it any differently? You think they would have changed anything? Sometimes the furnace is the best thing to happen. That's what Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 1. He tells us trials can be beneficial. No, they're not pleasant at the time, but they can be of great benefit to us. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 through 9, Peter says this, "In this now you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen you love, though now you do not see him, yet believing you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls." These trials were going to bring them nearer to Jesus and nearer to their eternal home. The fires of trial through which they would pass would refine their character, purge out the dross, and bring forth the gold. Remember this too. Trials are not always indicative of sin. A lot of times we make the mistake that Job's friends made. We find ourselves in difficulty and we begin to run through the list. What have I done? Why is this happening to me? What bad thing have I done to cause this to happen to me? And the fact of the matter is, trials do not always indicate the presence of sin in our lives. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2. If Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, if that doesn't convince us of the fact, look at 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 20. Peter writes and says, "What credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, suffering patiently. To this you were called, because Christ also suffered. Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow in His steps," the very next verse, "who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found within His mouth." Just because you're going through a hard time does not necessarily mean you've done something wrong. Jesus didn't do anything wrong, and He went to the cross. these brethren here to whom Peter is writing had not done anything wrong, and yet they were going to be suffering for doing good. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah took a stand for God, and they had to face down this trial. Trials are not always indicative of sinful behavior. And when we find ourselves in the trial, as you turn over to Hebrews chapter 11, when we find ourselves in the furnace, sometimes we escape. Hebrews chapter 11, we read it last night, verses 34 and 35. Those who by faith quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. But here's the reality. Sometimes we escape the flame, and sometimes we succumb. Not to sin. No, that's not what we're talking about. Sometimes the trial prevails. Sometimes the flames will get us. That's what happened in Hebrews 11 and 35. Now, keep it in its context. Keep it in its context. All of these people, Hebrews 11, have been acting by what? By faith. We're not in any different context when you come to verse 35. Verse 35, you've still got people acting by faith. And what? Verse 35 goes on to say others were tortured. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had trial of mockings and scourging, yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, Stephen. They were sawn in two. History tells us that would be Isaiah. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. We will face trials. And sometimes by faith we will come through. And other times by faith, because we choose to exercise faith, we may succumb. But again, keep it in its context here. Why are these people succumbing to the trial? Because they have faith, verse 35. Refusing to accept deliverance so that they might obtain a better resurrection. The truth is this. The fire cannot take our faith. That's Romans chapter 8. Nothing can separate us from the love of God which is in Jesus Christ. Not peril, not sword, not famine, nothing. The only thing that can separate me from the love of God is me. That's why Daniel purposed in his heart to serve God, that he would not defile himself. And when he made that decision, when he lived by that decision, no one could touch him. They could throw him in the den of lions. They could threaten him with his life. But they couldn't take his faith. And they couldn't take his hope. The hope which you and I have today, the Hebrew writer talks about, is based upon Jesus Christ. Upon the sacrifice that He gave on Calvary's cross. That is our hope. And through faith in Him, Paul tells us in Colossians chapter 2, in the waters of baptism, we are raised to walk a new life. If you've never come to Jesus Christ, if you've never lived out faith in Him, if you've never met Him in the waters of baptism and risen by faith to live a new life, you need to do that. You can have the hope of an eternity, a hope that can see you through every trial in this life. It's available and you can have it. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation this evening, would you come while we stand and while we sing?